Hi, this is Paul. I'm back from Australia. Had a terrific time there. Wound up with an extra day there, thanks to the airlines. But I'm not going to talk about that now. The event was recorded, and myself and Warren, who put the event together, will be releasing some of the video of it at least. So we've got that to come. But it's Friday, and Sunday's coming, and I'm a pastor, and I have to preach this week. So this is Rough Draft for Sunday. Medical technology. Wouldn't we all celebrate the cure for cancer? How about a miracle drug to end heart disease? Certainly, everyone in the world would be excited about such things, don't you think? Surely, if there's something we can see as an unmitigated good, it's advances, it is, oh, that those conjunctions. Hang on. No, I was right. It is advances in medicine to prolong and improve life. Or maybe not. Luke, or John 11, has what Frederick Dale Bruner, he has a wonderful commentaries on the Gospel of Matthew and also on the Gospel of Mark. He calls this Jesus' Lazarus sermon, which I think is such a insightful way of observing John 11. John 11 very famously begins with Lazarus being sick, and Jesus intentionally delays him getting there, and he tells his disciples that he's doing that so that you may believe. Now, just as in the, I know a bunch of you are waiting for me to do a video on Jordan Peterson at Liberty U, and I certainly plan on it. It'll probably have to wait until next week. But just as Jordan Peterson said to David Nasser, was a little hard on David. I loved that line, and I thought Peterson was exactly right. A little hard on Lazarus and the sisters. They're your friends, Jesus. I spoke about John 11 in my eulogy for my sister, and you can find that earlier on my channel. Jesus isn't always too easy on his friends. That's something to remember about Jesus. And Jesus delays it and tells his disciples so that you may believe. And then Lazarus dies. And then Jesus comes. And Mary and Martha both complain, Jesus, if you had gotten here quickly, he wouldn't have died. And then Jesus goes to the tomb and he weeps angrily and he raises Lazarus from the dead. Now, we like to end the story here in our telling of it because, well, that's kind of how we orient our movies. We have the big happy ending and then we all go home happy. And surely, just like medical technology, who would object to Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead? I mean, no one, to our knowledge, no one had anything in Lazarus's illness or death. He wasn't assassinated. No one tried to kill him. He died of an illness. Now, who could possibly be against this? Well, what we see in this is should give us some insight into what the Gospel of John calls the world, and some insight into ourselves. Therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. What are we accomplishing? They asked. Here is this man performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and then the Romans will come and take away both our temple and our nation. Now, this is one of these passages which for me just gives me just always encourages in me the belief that the New Testament is true, and these stories are not just made up, because the type of connection and insight that is revealed here between the raising of Lazarus and the threat that Jesus was to the status quo is deeply penetrating and insightful. And many casual, even casual readers of the New Testament, even determined readers who think about this, probably don't sink down into its depths to understand just what a threat Jesus was and why. certainly there's envy involved here in terms of Jesus, but and the other religious leaders of his day. But to understand how allowing this man would place at risk even the equilibrium that the Sanhedrin didn't like. And in fact, that equilibrium would eventually be lost. The temple gets destroyed in 70 AD, and there will be numerous rebellions by Jews who want to overthrow their Roman overlords and rid and purify the land of the Roman occupation. But the fact that this raising of Lazarus is so potent a threat is something that we should really think about and understand. It actually gets played up in some of the superhero movies lately. Superman, in a movie recently, the one in which he died, I think it's the one in which he dies. I can't keep track of all these movies all the time. But I loved it that he's hauled up in front of Congress, because this is actually a realistic thinking. And the same thing goes for Iron Man. And of course, a little bit less, Superman always takes himself so seriously. Iron Man never takes himself too seriously. Or at least Tony Stark doesn't. But one man's power is a deep threat to us. You see, technology, I'm going to reorder these slides, hang on. I don't know why I tell you to hang on when I just pause the video and you don't have to wait for me. See, here's the difference between technology and a superhero. That technology is common, and in a sense, Iron Man is a little bit this way too. It's the whole thing with his suit. But technology is something that all can theoretically employ, even though we don't. We're actually more comfortable with the idea of the limitations that are our social constructs among us in terms of wealth and poverty. But to have someone who can decide to take life or to give it, I always mess up those two words. Hang on. But to have someone who can decide to take life or to give it, this we protest. And I think this is always at the heart of, now I've talked about communism, Calvinism a fair amount. I'm always more relaxed when I get back from vacation. Calvinism. And the deep, how it disturbs many people, the idea that God picks and chooses. Well, history picks and chooses all the time. In fact, there's all kinds of selection that goes on. But to imagine that God picks and chooses, this deeply disturbs us. Why? Because we like to imagine ourselves as the authors of our own existence. You know, Neo says it in the movie The Matrix, how I don't like to think that anybody else is in charge of my life. Yeah, we don't like to think that, but it's certainly true. Why? You know, it's always about trust, isn't it? If there's a medical technology that can save us, well, that's good. But if it's up to a person, you know, it goes back to Sarah Palin's death panels. If it's up to a person, but it's often up to people. We just don't like to think of it that way. I love this part from an Oscar Wilde play. This is, of course, Lazarus is not the only time Jesus raises someone from the dead. The daughter of Jairus was dead. He raised her from the dead. Herod. He raises the dead? First Nazarene. Yes, sir. He raises the dead. Herod. I do not wish him to do that. I forbid him to do that. I allow no man to raise the dead. This man must be found and told that I forbid him to raise the dead. Where is this man at present? He is in every place, my lord, but it is hard to find him. It is said that he is now in Samaria. It is easy to see that this is not Messiah if he is in Samaria. It is not the Samaritans that the Messiah, it is not to the Samaritans that the Messiah comes, or Samaritans are accused. They bring no offerings to the temple, second Nazarene. He left Samaria a few days ago. I think at present moment he's in the neighborhood of Jerusalem. No, he is not. I have just come from Jerusalem for 2 months. We've had no tidings of him. Herod, no matter. But let them find him, and let him find and tell him from me. I will not allow him to raise the dead. I love Herod telling Jesus not to raise the dead. To change water into wine, to heal the lepers and the blind. He may do these things if he wills. I say nothing against these things. In truth, I hold it a good deed to heal a leper. But I allow no one to raise the dead. It would be terrible if the dead came back. A little bit earlier in the play, one soldier notices of Herod. We must bear away the body to another place. The Tetrarch does not care to see dead bodies. Save the bodies of those whom he himself has slain. Oscar Wilde's a very sharp guy. That was very, very true. And that's exactly it, isn't it? In the gospel narratives, Herod wants Jesus to come forward to do some tricks for him. Maybe some water to wine. Maybe heal a leper. Wow, wouldn't that be amazing? But raising the dead unseats the power. What power? The power that the Apostle Paul says that the state has. The power of the sword. For Jesus to raise the dead undermines the power of the sword and puts every state ill at ease. One of them named Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, spoke up. You know nothing at all. You do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than the whole world perish? Isn't that kind of the central issue that Captain America has during some of the more recent Marvel movies? He did not say this on his own, but as high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation, and not only for that nation, but also for the scattered children of God, to bring them together and make them one. From that day on, they plotted to take his life. Therefore, Jesus no longer moved about publicly among the people of Judea. Instead, he withdrew to a region near the wilderness, to a village named Ephraim, where he stayed with his disciples. It's so interesting that Jesus hides, because again, you have the sense of power here, because one who can raise the dead with a word could clearly take life with a word. I mean, which is easier, to raise the dead or to kill? We kill all the time. We can't raise the dead. When it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, many went up to the country to Jerusalem for their ceremonial cleansing before the Passover. They kept looking for Jesus. As they stood in the temple courts, they asked one another, "What do you think? Isn't he coming to the festival at all?" But the chief priests and the Pharisees had given orders that anyone who found out where Jesus was should report it so that they might arrest him, get their little police state going. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, where Lazarus lived, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. It's very interesting. The Gospel of John keeps reminding us as if we could forget. Here a dinner was given in Jesus' honor. It's a banquet. Martha served, just like she always does, while Lazarus was among those reclining at the table with him. Then Mary took about a pint of pure nard, an expensive perfume. She anointed it on Jesus' feet and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. Now, this is so interesting because Jesus and banquet scenes are always really important. If you read the Gospel of Luke, you see Jesus at banquets all the time. And banquets are almost always places of talk of heaven and hell, places where the kingdom comes, and places where people are excluded. And this ties these chapters together, because just in John chapter 11, when Jesus commands the tomb to be opened, people protest because of the stench. But now this room, now with Lazarus in it, is filled with fragrance. And we're seeing heaven and hell juxtaposed here. But one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected. "Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It is worth a year's wages." He did not say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. As keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. Now, that little parenthetical comment is really interesting, and it makes you wonder. Well, that actually doesn't make me wonder. Did Jesus know Judas was a thief? Why does Jesus choose Judas among the 12? Did the disciples know that Judas was plucking into the money bag? Is this some later editor that wanted to undo his reputation, as if selling out Jesus wouldn't be sufficient to do that? Let's imagine for a moment Jesus knew that Judas was stealing from the money bag, from the money given to the poor, and Jesus lets him. And in a strange way, Judas here is a sort of social justice warrior, but one who, well, I'm not going to say social justice warriors steal from the poor, but he wants to speak for the poor while he's actually benefiting from benevolence to the poor. "Leave her alone," Jesus replied. "It is intended that she should save this perfume for the day of my burial. You will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me." Meanwhile, a large crowd of Jews found out that Jesus was there and came not only because of him, but also to see Lazarus. There's the show. Got to find Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead, as if we would forget. So the chief priests made plans to kill Lazarus as well. On account of him, many of the Jews were going over to Jesus and believing in him. Nice little inclusio to frame this section. In Judas's objection to Jesus' costly anointing by Mary, we see a show of concern for the poor, empty of first-person action. Jesus, "the poor you will always have with you," may seem callous coming from a cis male to especially woke ears, but invites us further in. Judas lives off a showy concern for the poor, making sure the left hand is not alone in knowing what the right hand is doing, without understanding the source of concern for the poor. The poor are ubiquitous, always available, unlike generosity's source. I often think of the fact that there's, if you imagine the world as two lines, those who wish to be loved and those who in fact love. And what I mean here by love is 1 Corinthians 13 style love. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love is not easily angered. Love keeps no record of wrongs. Love always hopes, always perseveres. This kind of love everyone wants to receive, but this kind of love is so costly to give. This kind of love we all wish to be seen as giving, at least now 2,000 years after Jesus. But this kind of love the world cannot get enough of. Jesus himself embodies all privilege. None are more privileged than the Son of God. The Gospels work on themes of privilege and poverty, themes of status all the time. And Jesus comes in with the one who has absolutely all privilege. He can raise the dead with a word. And then you might wonder, why not go through the cemetery just popping them up like daisies, Jesus? Why not go into the hospital? I had a conversation with my friend Warren when I was in Australia, and we talked about Bill Johnson, who is the pastor of Bethel Church in Reading, very, very popular, very famous church, just a couple hours north of us here. And I read Bill's book, and I guess my question with it is, if in fact the kingdom comes in the ways that some imagine it comes, shouldn't we be clearing out hospitals? Why does Jesus hand out miracles the way he does? Why are they always, as Frederick Bruner says, sermons? Now, as a Christian, I believe the resurrection is coming. As a Christian, I believe all of this world's injustices, all of this world's diseases will in fact be addressed. But the thing that bothers us about Jesus is he picks and chooses. He chose his friends. He chose to raise Lazarus, but he chose to wait until Lazarus had died. Yeah, a little hard on David. there at Liberty University. A little hard on Lazarus and Mary and Martha, too. But Jesus is making a point. And we really don't want him making this point, because we really don't want him. We really don't want to trust him. Jesus himself embodies all privilege. None are more privileged than the Son of God, yet is about to empty himself in a public show, which is the inversion of the generosity posturing Judas's empty heart feeds off of. Judas wishes to live off the generosity of others to make himself look good. Jesus will make himself look bad. The book of Deuteronomy talks about how despised it is to hang on a tree. How Jesus will be splayed naked for the mockery of the crowd. And many who had hoped in him will have second thoughts when they see, well, he was a man who could call the dead from the tomb. And actually, in the Gospel of John, when they confront him in the Garden of Gethsemane, they all fall back. Because one who could still a storm could certainly conjure a storm. Such a man could defeat an army. Such a man would have to die. Jesus will let himself be died. Killed. Ah, the English language. Will let himself be killed. Jesus will submit to his whipping. Jesus will not get out of these trumped up charges, even though all of the accounts show that even a corrupt middleman like Pilate could see that Jesus was innocent. Jesus will go to the cross. We find ourselves clamoring against oppression and injustice, but who is doing the cruciform work of listening to the homeless schizophrenic babble or changing the diaper of the elderly? We all want to be seen as saviors, but real saving usually requires bearing a cross. The raising of Lazarus illuminates the world. We want the power to raise some of the dead, but only on our terms. We cannot allow this power to remain in the hands of one who will resist us and our competition of petty moralisms. The brightness of his life makes us look less than. The abandonment of such high privilege exposes the poverty of our doing deeds for the eyes of those we wish to impress. We hate him, Golan would say, and we must kill him. Jesus converts the tomb of Lazarus into a banquet hall. Instead of the stench of Lazarus's death, it is now filled with the fragrance of Mary's costly gift. This is how Mary is illuminating the gospel. This is how Mary is embodying the gospel. And Jesus knows it and sees it. Judas has no ear for it. This cannot be tolerated. Jesus and Lazarus must be killed. Jesus notes this. It was intended that she should save this perfume for the day of my burial, Jesus says. She anoints him in anticipation of it. So what is the world? What is this combination of powers and forces that ensures that things as they are remain as they always will be? It hasn't changed from the first century. What is it about me and no one else? Because it is me. I am part of this world. I am embedded in this. I am Judas. We like, after the Charlie Hebdo things, we like to say, I am Charlie Hebdo. I am the victim. No, I am the perpetrator. It is me that resists God's picking and choosing. The patterns persist. It is no different for us or with us. So which path will you choose? The poor are still with us. Will you serve them? Will you do for them? Will you do it quietly so that the right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing? Or the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing? Do you dare to believe in the source of this generosity? The ones who picks and chooses. The ones whose power we see.